They've watched Citizen Kane a combined 200 times. Elliot's first words were, "I personally thought the use of Dutch angles was derivative in the 400 blows." In Nathan's favorite historical figure is Fritz Lang. Now they're bringing that snootiness to you with Magellan's at the Movies.
Welcome back, faithful listeners. Quick PSA before we get into our banter. This is episode 160. Typically, this would be, well, I say typically, but we missed it last time too. So usually we would do a special episode for these episodes. We're currently working on compiling our movies for our Best of the 60s episode. Just working to make that as comprehensive as we feasibly can while also trying to deliver it in a decent amount of time. Not spending the next 2 years only watching movies from the 60s. So we're going to be getting to that very soon. In the meantime, we're going to be doing regular episodes, regular reviews. If you have an idea for a special episode, we're kind of, well, I have a great idea that Elliot doesn't want to do, but we're always happy to hear ideas for a special episode. If there's like a franchise that could be looked at, if there's a ranking of a director or something, I don't know. If you have an idea, feel free to email us. Let us know what you think would be fun to do as a special episode. So anyway, now we're going into the banter. Elliot, you said you had things you want to discuss. What are those things? I'm so excited to discuss them with you.
Well, it's really just some bits and bobs from movies today, right?
Sure.
It's a fictional magazine that I've just made up.
Okay.
In terms of reviews, reactions to things coming out, Honey Don't appears to continue the trend of Ethan Coen ejecting all of his credibility, unfortunately.
Amazing.
That's a little harsh, but it's not been well received. But you can find out for yourself. I think, let me see, when does it release? August 22nd. So tomorrow.
Yeah.
Tomorrow, if you want, you can test the abysmal critic score and see if it holds up. Also in theaters right now is, I'm not going to be able to pronounce this correctly, but Neja 2.
Neja 2, yes.
Yeah. Yes. This is a Chinese animated movie.
Yep.
This is one of the most successful movies in film history. Okay. Mm-hmm. I think this is in the top 10 of highest grossing movies.
Yeah.
Partly because there's a lot of people in China, and partly because this is reportedly an exceptional film. And now that it's gotten a wider release, although I think it might be, for its international release, it might be dubbed rather than subbed, which I do not appreciate. But anyway, it's been getting rave reviews, all kinds of 5 out of 5s and 10 out of 10s, yeah, and A pluses, and everyone loves this movie, so I don't know. Maybe you should. Has anyone seen it? Should you watch Neja 1 before you watch Neja 2? Let us know.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, before we move on, Nathan, have either of these movies been on your radar? Do you want to watch either of them? I know you really liked Drive Away Dolls. You're such a fan of Ethan Coen's solo work. So I'm assuming the answer is a resounding yes.
No. I don't think you could. The only way I'm going to watch Honey Don't is if I get really sick any time between now. Because every time I'm really sick, that's when I watch movies that I know I will hate, that I know are terrible, because I'm sick. I don't want to have to engage critically and meaningfully with a beautiful, well-put-together piece of art. I want to watch some slop that is just terrible that I can just watch and be like, dang, they really suck at making movies. Like, this is awful. That's the only way I would watch Honey Don't, because, yeah, Drive Away Dolls, one of the worst movies of the decade, has almost no redeeming features. Two, maybe just actually having no redeeming features. really annoying. It convinces me that I think Ethan Coen was the sole writer on Barton Fink. I think he locked Joel out of the writer's room when he made that movie or something. In terms of Ne-Zha 2, I've heard of it. It's getting a bunch of marketing pushes. I must be in the target demographic because every other ad I get is some woman telling me that she just saw the movie and it blew her mind. It was so amazing and I should go see it. I don't think I'll go and see this in theaters. It seems like the kind of thing I'd try to catch after the fact, as well as, yeah, I don't know if I should see the first one before I watch the second one. That's typically the way I go about watching franchises, movies that follow one another chronologically, but maybe if it gets enough buzz, I'll have to go in and just watch this one and find some way to see the first one later.
Well, by all means, I feel the same. I have no intention of watching Honey Don't, certainly not in theaters. As regards Ne-Zha 2, I guess I'll see what happens. Although I really don't like watching dubbed movies. Let's shift to a slightly different sphere, video games. GamesCon is happening right now, or it might be. And was happening yesterday and the day before. I don't know, but there has been some interesting stuff happening there, coming out of there. Not a whole lot of stuff that relates to movies, although, I don't know if you've seen this, but Onimusha, Way of the Sword, which is a remake, I think? Not a remaster. A remake of an old Capcom game is being remade. It looks really good. I'm really interested in it. And the player character has been made in the likeness of Toshihiro Mifune, of course, Samurai Cinema's most famous star, which I think is pretty neat.
Interesting.
The other thing that's more pertinent to a film or visual arts podcast is an anime adaptation of Sekiro: Shadows Die Twice. This is the Crunchyroll, I think, is the studio handling this. And they are striking while the iron is ice cold. This is a, like, what, 8-year-old game.
Yeah.
And they're making an adaptation of it. I actually don't know if it's an adaptation of the game or it's just set in the game's universe. It seems to have all the characters from the game, so I'm assuming it's an adaptation. I really enjoy Sekiro. And Sekiro is unique amongst the From Software catalog for having such a straightforward, dialogue-heavy narrative. I mean, dialogue-heavy for a From Software game, right? It's not actually dialogue-heavy. But yeah, I feel like this could work really well. Sekiro has a really... Well, I can see a lot of avenues for adapting or just sort of grafting onto a TV show the different things that made Sekiro cool, like its art direction, its fast-paced sword play, the main character who's kind of like a Master Chief kind of gruff, man of few words, man of action character. So I'm color me intrigued, but Nathan, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it looks interesting. I don't know if it's something that I'd go super far out of my way to try and watch, just because if it is just a rehash of the story of Sekiro, I don't think its story is so good as to justify me watching it again but not playing it, since that's most of the fun of a video game is playing it. So, I don't know. We'll see. I'm interested. Maybe this is what you were going to talk about next. But did you see the new trailer for the Fallout TV show for season 2?
Oh, man. I completely forgot about that. Nathan, Okay. Thank you for saving me from myself. I did see that.
Yep.
I am pretty darn excited. I really enjoyed the first season. And honestly, if this season is just more of the same, I would be pretty pleased. This is set in New Vegas or around New Vegas. I have played New Vegas. It's a great game. Everyone knows it. Obviously, there's a lot of questions about what it's going to do and how it's going to fit into the canon of that game because of Fallout New Vegas, like all of the Fallout games, at least the modern ones, had multiple endings, so it's kind of hard to set this story in a post-New Vegas after that game on the timeline and not have to give it a canon ending, but we'll see what happens. I'm not so precious about canon that I would be particularly upset if they went one way or the other. And yeah, just in general, I'm just excited. I want to see it. I want to see where these characters go. I want to spend more time with them. I want to hear more of Ramin Djawadi's generational score. Holy cow. I said it so many times when the show was coming out, but the music is freaking incredible. And I'm really excited to see or hear rather what he spins up for us this time.
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. I think it's also really neat that it struck me as I was watching the trailer and the big reveal in the trailer, I guess if you want to go in completely cold with no spoilers at all, this is a bit of a spoiler, but the big reveal in the trailer is that a Deathclaw is going to show up at some point in this season.
And Nathan, you're revealing yourself to not have played the game because...
It's not a Deathclaw?
No, it's that I think for game players, most game players, this is not something I particularly resonated with, but for a lot of people, the biggest part of the trailer was the implication that Caesar's Legion will be present in the show.
I guess I noted that. I guess I was just going to say in terms of iconography of the Fallout franchise, I think one of the things that's kind of impressive about the first season is how little of the iconography it necessarily feels it has to bring or use. And certainly in an era of nostalgia bait and let me throw a billion things so you can Leonardo DiCaprio at the screen for the entirety of the episode, I think it's kind of refreshing to see a show wait until its second season to pull out something that I would say is one of the most iconic pieces of Fallout iconography in the Deathclaw. Obviously, yeah, this season is going to be stuffed to the gills with references to the video games with, Caesar's Legion, that weird computer guy who I know shows up in New Vegas.
Mr. House.
Sure, whatever you say, dude. But I just think it's neat that the first season didn't rely so much on iconography that it feels like it's having to dig up like the dregs of random stuff in order to have new things to be notable in the second season. It didn't overplay its hand in the first season, so now in the second season it gets to pull out the Deathclaw. It gets to pull out, you know, some of the bigger guns, and I think that's neat. Maybe we'll see someone with, isn't it a Fat Boy, is that what it's called, the nuke launching gun?
Oh, the Fat Man.
Yeah, yeah. Someone will pull out that.
Fat Boy.
Whatever. Vault Boy, Fat Man. There's too many men and boys.
Yes. I'm really excited for this. This is probably the most excited I've been for a TV show since probably season 4 of Better Call Saul.
Wow.
At least I think it was season 3 of Better Call Saul that ended on this insane cliffhanger. Actually, season 2 did as well. Anything Better Call Saul. Everyone look forward to that. Make sure... I don't know. I'm rambling at this point.
All right.
That's all I have. Nathan, do you have anything else you want to talk about?
No, I say let's jump into this episode.
Yes, let's jump in, as Nathan can't stop himself from saying, to the episode, which concerns... the return. Now, there is every chance that you, the listener, are not familiar with this movie, because this is one of those movies that is made on a very low budget. It's kind of an awards bait movie. It doesn't get the kind of overwhelmingly positive response that usually you need in order to get real awards buzz, didn't have much marketing push, and then kind of fades into obscurity. So this is, if you didn't know, this is an adaptation of the latter portions of the Odyssey, the poem, when Odysseus returns to Ithaca, bereft of all his cool stuff, and sort of, well, Ithaca, his wife Penelope is sort of being held hostage by the suitors, who are people who want her hand in marriage so that they can become king of Ithaca and get access to Odysseus's treasures. Why they can't just kill Penelope and take it anyway. I mean, look, Homer was writing before CinemaSins was invented, so he didn't really think about that. So yeah, this movie is an adaptation of that, and you've got a lot of stuff that people who have read the poem, which I've read the poem, Nathan's read the poem, will recognize. But it's not a straightforward adaptation. It's a much more stripped back, pared down, kind of grounded adaptation. There's no gods. Athena is not a part of it. There's no indication that while he's been gone, Odysseus has been, right, doing battle with cyclopes and sea monsters and hanging out with Calypso. So, yeah, I watched this in theaters when it came out, which was last year. And I enjoyed it for the most part, but found problems with it. And then I kind of didn't think about it for a while. And then a few weeks ago, I noticed it. I just saw it on one of the streaming services, and I was like, oh, it's been a while since I watched that. Maybe I should rewatch it, because I read The Odyssey last year. Not last year, this year. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I found the way the movie adapted the poem to be really interesting, and it just seemed like the kind of movie that Nathan, I don't know, might like or might dislike. It's hard to predict. It seemed like the kind of movie that would prompt some interesting conversations about the things it's trying to do and whether it succeeds or not. And so, yeah, well, first of all, let's hear Nathan. What did you think about this movie? Because this is the first time you've seen it. This is some fresh thoughts we're about to get. So, yeah, let's have it.
Yeah, I think it is, like you said, a very interesting adaptation of this latter part of the Odyssey poem. And I think it takes a really big swing narratively and thematically for something more interesting, or at least diving a little deeper into something that is present but not necessarily brought to the surface of the poem. And I think I really respect the movie for the swing it's taking. I don't think it really nails the ending, and I think if it had, it would be a movie that I would be gushing about. I'd be really nutty about it. I'd be telling tons of people you should watch it. I'd bring it up whenever I see Christopher Nolan's version. But I think as the movie stands, it's just kind of a neat experiment that is fun to think about. And I agree, I think it's going to be interesting to talk about what the movie does well and what the movie does poorly, because it is, like I said, it's taking a big swing. Maybe not a big swing, but it's trying for something very interesting, I think. So I just don't think it necessarily nails the landing, which isn't entirely its fault, because I don't really think the original poem really nails the ending of the actual poem. I feel like is kind of a lame ending, but that's just me. I haven't written anything that survived 3,000 years or however long it's been since Homer wrote this thing.
Well, technically,
oh, good grief,
Homer's poem has not survived, because of course the poem would have been recited orally rather than written down, and the oldest living copy we have of the Odyssey is, I believe, like centuries older than when the Odyssey first shows up in the historical record, and is actually, it's from a completely different place. So the odds of our version of the Odyssey being verbatim Homer's words are exceptionally low.
Wow.
Which what is a just an interesting historical fun fact. Nathan, I agree. I agree with you. I was a little sad because I like this movie less on second watch than I did on the first watch. I found its problems to be much more prominent and its strengths to be much less prominent. Mm-hmm. And I think my biggest problem with this movie is definitely that it feels very thematically muddled. Mm-hmm. And I don't think by the end it's many different themes and ideas are resolved particularly well, or even at all. And it's funny, I think that we have some very strong evidence for this, and I'm not trying to be like pretentious, be like, oh, I'm right because I have all this evidence, but I did notice, because I read a lot of reviews for this movie, because I wanted to see, were people seeing the same thing that I was? And I noticed a very distinct divide between, in the positive reviews, between those who said that it was a very thoughtful and interesting interrogation of violence and warfare, and those who seemed to find it to be just a pretty straightforward adaptation of the Odyssey, albeit without the spectacle of Athena and hundreds of suitors and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that there is certainly a lot of people have come away from this movie with a lot of different ideas. And I know that there's a school of thought when it comes to movies that prioritizes that kind of thematic, I don't know, not necessarily ambiguity, but a certain level of blankness upon which the audience can construct their own interpretation. The idea being that movies should be universal, right? And they shouldn't divide people and stuff like that, which I understand to, and I'm sympathetic to a certain degree, but ultimately I think that a movie that says everything to everyone is ultimately saying nothing. Mm. So yeah, it's just that it really, excuse me. The things that I find most interesting about this movie don't feel like they are carried through to the end. Feels like they kind of fall by the wayside, especially at the end when Odysseus, spoilers for a 1,000-year-old poem, kills all the suitors. Yeah. I feel like that little capstone for the movie, I found it very difficult to tell if this was meant to be a tragic relapse of Odysseus returning to his old ways, a triumphant defeat of a morally and unambiguously evil antagonist, or a regrettable but necessary thing that Odysseus doesn't really feel good about, but ultimately had to do. So yeah, I've kind of already dived in here. So let's start with that. Nathan, you say your piece about this movie's themes and the extent to which they landed for you or didn't.
I absolutely agree with everything you're saying, Elliot. I think the strongest thematic push that I get from this movie is exactly that question of, we get the sense that Odysseus has a bit of PTSD, shell shock, as they called it in those days.
ballista shock.
Exactly, yeah. He has been through some stuff, and it's constantly brought up in this early section of the movie where Odysseus is kind of wandering around Ithaca, seeing the state of his kingdom and talking to Eumaeus, I don't know how to pronounce his name. But he's talking.
The herder.
And he tells Wright a story about taking Troy, and the story he tells is a decidedly unglamorous story, right? That the young guy who's there is like, oh, so you guys you captured Troy, you won. And Odysseus is like, no, there was nothing to win. Like, we burned everything and killed everyone. There was no glory, there was no excitement. It was just like a brutal ending of life. And he appears to be fairly upset by this. He's upset by the fact that he's the only person who returned. Obviously, we don't see any of the ways that his crewmen, his fellow soldiers, his fellow men of Ithaca died, but he's the only one who makes it back. All the rest of them died through the movie's a little more realistic than the poem, so I don't know. Their ship just crashed and they all drowned, maybe. But this has really taken its toll on him. And so the movie is also building a case. While it's building this characterization of Odysseus, the movie is building a case for how, like you mentioned, decidedly disgusting and awful the suitors are, right? They're constantly shown to be fornicating in random hallways, as evil people do. They are assaulting the women of Ithaca, they're stealing the food of Ithaca, they're uncaring towards the poor and the blind. This is way better than, I love to bring this up just because I find it so funny in the poem how often Odysseus like antagonizes the suitors, and then when they're rude back to him, like, he'll shove them, and then when they shove him back, he's like, this is why they deserve to die. The movie did a better job than that, where the suitors are genuinely doing things that there should be some justice for. There should be some recompense, that we as the audience are wanting these people to get their just desserts. And so these two ideas of Odysseus not wanting to be violent or perpetuate violence or continue this strain of violence that he's seen in the Trojan War, and the suitors being very deserving of the kind of violence that Odysseus meted out in the Trojan War. This is a really interesting way to look at the Odyssey. It's such an interesting framework for a movie. I was very interested in it. And exactly like you said, the movie basically just shrugs and is like, I don't know, bro, that sounds kind of tough. Because it does. And I think it's not even just that the climax is kind of confusing in terms of how should we feel about the climax, or how does any of the characters even feel about the climax? I think the moment where the movie really lost me is the first time Odysseus kills someone that the suitors are coming to kill Telemachus, his son, and he kills these two people. It feels like such a non-moment when I'm like, this is the turning point of the entire movie. Like, Odysseus has refused to be violent up to this point. He's refused to engage with the suitors very much, and now he's killing them, and there's nothing. There's no point. There's no amount of Odysseus being like, dang, I feel kind of bad that now we're going back down this path. And then the climax just kind of continues this trend. And so I think the movie opens with a lot of really interesting ideas, and then doesn't go anywhere with that, or doesn't create anything interesting, and just becomes like the ending to the Odyssey. I've seen this ending in the book.
Yeah, there's a lot. I have a lot of thoughts here.
Yeah.
I think that there are two main problems. One is that Odysseus, the core of Odysseus's struggle, I think, is a little unclear. Is it that he doesn't want to be violent in principle because he thinks that violence is wrong now, or is of a different mind towards it than he was when he went to Troy? Mm-hmm. Or is it just that he has this personal feeling of failure, that he didn't save his men. He's coming back alone. And so he just feels like he doesn't necessarily deserve the title of King of Ithaca anymore. The other problem is that the action is way too cool to be, what, to be somber, to be meaningful.
Yeah.
Like, Odysseus dispatches these guys with some style.
Mm-hmm.
And he does afterwards look at them while they're bleeding, and he's got a bit of a sad face, and the music is reflective. But that's about it. And he was not, he did not display reluctance when he was walking up to them, right? He didn't say, like, he didn't try to head it off and say, like, oh, the person you're looking for isn't here. Or even, like, I don't want this fight. Go away. You don't want this fight. Yeah. Or anything like that. And the same thing happens in the hall with the suitors, where he doesn't seem that bothered about killing them. Mm-hmm. And again, the music is not necessarily triumphant, and there's some slow motion shots and a bit of echo on the in the sound mixing. But yeah, Odysseus, he chooses to kill the suitors almost immediately after shooting an arrow through the axe heads. There's no moment of hesitation or wondering. And so it just feels like, and this is one of the things that drove me to read all these reviews, is I was thinking, like, am I wrong? Are we wrong? Is the movie not trying to say that Odysseus has developed any kind of aversion to violence at all? And this is just something that we're reading into it. And I don't think that we are, because that scene, first of all, that scene where he is in the swineherd's house with these other guys, and he tells them the story of how Troy was destroyed, that is the reason why I wanted to rewatch this movie. Mm-hmm. Because let's say what does not need to be said, Ralph Fiennes is fantastic in this movie.
Yeah.
Like, he is absolutely, you don't need me to tell you that Ralph Fiennes is a good actor, and he can sell that hollow, distant stare of a traumatized veteran. And again, that's the most interesting part of this movie, is framing it as not as the story of gods and monsters and heroes, but as the story of a veteran coming home from war.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like, it does seem to me at least, like this movie, this scene is setting up for Odysseus a new relationship to violence and to warfare. That, and it doesn't seem to me, and again, like, this is just personal, I may be misinterpreting things, but it doesn't seem to me like the movie is setting this up as something that Odysseus needs to overcome, right? If Odysseus was seen to be failing to protect others by choosing to stay out of violent confrontations, then I think I would be a little bit more on board with the people who see this as just a straightforward retelling of the Odyssey that's a little bit more gritty.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't get any of that. And so my reading of the film, in terms of Odysseus' character arc, is that it starts off one way and ends another.
Mm. Well, and I always find it helpful. The movie that I've been thinking of as we've been having this conversation, and I liked what you said at the beginning about movies that are kind of a blank slate, or movies that are very thematically rich, having some element of universality. And I think it's not necessarily universality in the sense that anyone can make up some nonsense and then the movie is meaningful. Like, some movies are really artsy and you could just make up anything and that's a valid interpretation because the movie gives you nothing. I think it's better when a movie is so good at introducing every audience member to an interesting philosophical or ethical or interesting moral debate, and then giving them all the tools they need to enter into that debate and start to formulate their own opinions as the movie presents different characters and different viewpoints to them. The movie that I always cite is Whiplash, that Whiplash is just incredible at bringing its ideas of the cost of fame, the toxic relationship with fame, and what is a person willing to sacrifice in order to be famous, and these questions, right, are brought to the forefront through the course of the story, and everyone I've ever talked to who's seen Whiplash has been able to meaningfully engage in a discussion of these concepts just from seeing Whiplash. They don't need any other things, and people have way different opinions, right? Some people think the end of Whiplash is a triumphant moment. Some people think, correctly, in my opinion, that it is a depressing moment, that it is a bad thing for the characters. But I think what's amazing is everyone is able to enter into that and start a discussion. And I think what makes this movie tough is it feels like I'm having to do a lot of the heavy lifting to enter into the discussion because the movie drops the ball. Like you said, the movie doesn't give us a lot of stuff to go on in terms of how we should feel about Odysseus's final scouring of the suitors, killing all of them, this massacre that occurs at the end of the movie. And I think, I mean, certainly people should, right, come away with an opinion of, was Odysseus right to do this? Was there another way to do this that would maybe be better, involve less bloodshed? But I think what's bad is the fact that the movie gives us nothing to go on. The ending is such a muddled mess. Like, Telemachus leaves inexplicably. I don't know where he's going, because that I don't think that happens in the poem. And this is, again, I don't think the poem has a great ending either. Because, to my recollection, Odysseus kills all the suitors. Their families are like, hey, we're kind of pissed. And Odysseus is just kind of like, hey, sorry, that's my bad. And then, like, that's the end of the poem. And it's kind of, I mean, I guess he's gotten back home, so it's irrelevant what happens afterwards in some sense. But I think what makes this movie frustrating is that it has all of these interesting philosophical ideas and all of these ethical questions about what should Odysseus do, what can Odysseus do in the state that he's in, and then it just kind of goes through rote Odyssey steps for the rest of the movie instead of following through on any of those ideas and questions. And it kind of has, I get a sense at the end that there's like, or at least I got the sense from his final conversation with Penelope, as well as that last shot of the blood kind of being disseminated through the water, that there was a sense that, like, everything's fine now because he's with Penelope and, like, love will cover all of his sins or something like that. Which, I mean, now I'm just critiquing it because if that is what the movie is saying at the end, I think that's stupid. I think that's dumb. It's one of my, I hate, every time I've watched West Side Story, this is a spoiler for West Side Story, but when the woman sings the song after her brother gets killed, is killed by the person that she loves, and she sings a song where she's like, well, love can kind of forgive things, and so, like, it's no big deal. I'm like, no, it is a big deal. Like, people for sure should be shown mercy and grace, but also they definitely can't go around doing whatever they want and then it's fine because someone's like, hey, it's okay, I love you, so, like, nothing matters then. I just think, and see, again, this is just my opinion of being, I don't agree with that ending if that's what the ending's saying, but all of this is my opinion, so, you know, and it's on the movie that it doesn't, there's movies that end in a place that I disagree with, but the movie's made a great case, and so I'm like, yeah, that's a great, that makes sense in the world of the movie for that to be the ending, but I don't really get the sense that the movie is going to a place of Penelope's love for Odysseus is gonna help him heal. They barely spent time together.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right, and I think that Whiplash is the perfect, I don't know, foil, counter to this, to the way this movie ends, in that Whiplash, in my opinion, ends very deliberately with the juxtaposition of the reactions of his father and Fletcher. His father being vaguely horrified and Fletcher being very approving.
Yeah.
And that kind of sets you up for this open question. That leaves the movie's question open of like, oh, well, who is right? Who are you? Who do you decide? Who do you side with? Vote now on your phones. Was the father right or was Fletcher right?
Yeah.
In contrast, the way the killing of the suitors is resolved, or it ends in the return, is Penelope is upset by the violence. She doesn't like the violence. In contrast to the book, where she doesn't really care. Because that's just, right, this is the culture of Homer at the time.
Yeah.
And so Penelope runs off, and this, to me, is kind of your opportunity as a filmmaker to kind of pass the ball to the audience and be like, who do you think is right? Because Penelope says, like, oh, it's a slaughterhouse. And what is her title? Her role?
The maid?
I felt like she had a more specific title. But sure, the maid says it had to be done. And then the question is dropped. And to me, that represents the movie resolving the question rather than passing it off to the audience. Because the question is not brought up again, and because the maid speaks so authoritatively and she is not challenged, to me, and again, like, this is all personal, this is just my reading of it, but to me, that is the movie saying, like, oh yeah, right, no, you don't want to see it happen, but it had to happen. Which I don't find particularly compelling. The other thing is that questions in movies, these kinds of dilemmas in movies, to me, are only compelling insofar as they have real stakes, right? Because in... now I'm not going to be able to think of a good example. In The Dark Knight, mm-hmm. Batman can either kill Joker or imprison him, right? Work within the bounds of his own personal moral code. In killing Joker, he essentially allows Joker the moral victory. Mm-hmm. That's Batman's rules, the movie's rules. The rules of society are only implemented insofar as they are convenient. If he lets Joker live, right, people will continue to die. That is an example, in my opinion, of a really good marriage of dilemma and stakes, because that's a question, that's a hard question, that's something the audience is invested in. I don't see anything similar in The Return, right? Yeah. I think a perfect example actually would be to introduce the idea of the families of the suitors, that in killing the suitors, Odysseus risks war or some kind of violent conflict with their relatives.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if he lets them live, right, they are still a force, still a threat. And that, right, that's just me spitballing. But the movie doesn't really have anything like that. The question of the film, insofar as it exists, which maybe it doesn't, we're just reading too much into it, but insofar as we have perceived the question of the film, it is not tied to any stakes. And again, like, you could also frame this kind of similar to The Dark Knight, in that Odysseus would see it as a personal failing, that he has regressed, he has returned to the person who he was at Troy, which it has been established, at least I think it has been established, is not something that he wants to go back to. That's another example of how you could actualize the stakes of these questions, but the movie doesn't do that, and in my opinion, it's the lesser for it.
Yeah. Well, and this is kind of what I find fascinating about movies, is that depending on what world the movie creates, that when you're watching a film, it introduces you to a series of characters and a series of morals and ethics and just an understanding of the genre of the movie you're watching. And using all of these tools, the movie, right, sucks you in and creates these, right, stakes and questions and stuff. And I think what's disappointing is when the world of the movie and certainly the philosophical questions of the movie that the movie brings to the forefront, it's always disappointing when all of those fall apart as soon as you start to pull on threads. And because I think you could just as well say, like, well, why can't we just grade this like a regular action movie? Like, is the action good? I don't think the action is so good to justify the entire movie, but I think it would be kind of like if in Die Hard it's established that, like, John McClane doesn't want to kill anyone, and then the rest of Die Hard happens normally. You'd be like, wow, that was kind of weird to set up something that doesn't go anywhere, to set up, like, John McClane is like a Vietnam War vet or something, and he doesn't want to have to kill people. It would be weird, right? If then for the rest of the movie, the movie's just like, yeah, isn't he kind of dope? Like, watch him super awesomely jump off this roof while he kills Hans Gruber. Isn't that awesome? That would be weird. And so the reason why it's weird in this movie is because this movie is doing exactly that thing. This movie is introducing ideas that it then doesn't run with. And so, and I think the other thing that's kind of a knock against this movie, to kind of talk about the other things, is there's not a lot of other stuff that's done particularly interestingly or compellingly to go to as a fallback. We already said Ralph Fiennes, incredible actor. I think the movie might be actually hurt by how good he is, because every other actor is not as good as him and is, like, noticeably not as good as him. And so all of the suitors are not very compelling. It doesn't help that they're unlikable, annoying people. And then,
dude, yeah, sorry, but just I think that also Ralph Fiennes does such a good performance of selling this haunted man that when he does revert, that it kind of enhances this perception of the movie.
Yeah.
As being about Odysseus's his thoughts about himself and his actions. So when he is then called upon to kill again, it kind of flies in the face of Ralph Fiennes' own performance. Sorry, continue.
Yeah, well, and I think everything else about the movie, it's tough to get behind it. I mean, the production is good. It looks like Grease, or at least it looks like I would think that Grease might look. I kind of shrug and say, yeah, it looks close enough, bro. The music is all right. The action is okay. It does a decent job. I will say the one scene that I think is really awesome is when Odysseus reunites with Argos seconds before Argos dies. That's crazy. That is such a bummer. That's so sad. That's a great moment, just in isolation. That's a great scene. But the rest of the movie doesn't do anything novel enough or interesting enough to justify its own existence. And the only thing I'm left with is like, oh, this is an interesting way to look at Odysseus as a traumatized returning war veteran. And then I'm like, oh, let's look inside the box. What else is there? Oh, nothing interesting. Or it doesn't go anywhere interesting. And so I'm just left with not a lot to work with here.
Well, yeah, and it's unfortunate because the nature of the film and the nature of the film's problems kind of necessitate that we focus on the latter half of it in much the same way that it's focused on the latter half of the Odyssey. Because the first half of the movie is genuinely really good.
Yeah.
Right? You've got this incredible scene with Odysseus where he describes Troy and what happened there. In my opinion, another example of a character who's kind of fumbled, Antinous, who's kind of like the, I don't know, primary antagonist, or at least a figure of a major figure among the suitors. Because Antinous, in the beginning, the way he goes about trying to win Penelope's hand is through subterfuge, and, right, he sort of, I don't know, he's trying to be nice to her and trying to woo her in a way that everyone else is not. Yeah. And even at the end, Antinous says, like, his words are, he says, right, that he is here out of a genuine affection for Penelope rather than a desire to usurp Odysseus or steal all of his treasure. But in between that, he's trying to murder her son.
Yeah.
Which is not the way to go about things. And I feel like as he set up, in this first part of the movie, I remember last night even thinking like, oh, wow, I don't remember Antinous being such an interesting character. Because he's not as much of an antagonist as the other suitors are. And then he's like, oh, hey, by the way, I would like for us to organize a hunting party and kill Telemachus.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, I guess I just forgot about that because that's not very good. That is not in line with Antinous as he's been shown, or at least as we've been led to perceive him, because, and I think as the movie is constructing him, because at the end, he even says, right, when he has basically no point in lying anymore, that he only ever wanted Penelope.
Mm-hmm.
In which case, why would you want to hurt the woman you love so deeply by murdering her son? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
Again, it's unfortunate that we have to... It's unfortunate that the movie doesn't follow through on all of the legitimately great, interesting promises that it makes in its initial offerings.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree that first half of the movie really got me hooked. I was so invested in seeing what the movie... This happens to me a lot of the times, is movies present a really interesting idea or question or just something that I'm chewing on for the entirety of the movie, and then the back half of it is just a disappointing dropping of the ball where I'm left like, okay... I don't have anywhere to go. I guess I can just sit here and think about these things in isolation. And, yeah, so it's disappointing. I've said everything I have to say here about the movie.
Well, I want to say a couple more positives. I think that the music is not bad. It's not something that I would listen to casually. But I appreciate that it's got a very clear theme that is kind of, I don't know, formulated in different ways throughout the movie. And sometimes, there are some times where it's deployed, I think, really effectively. Like, when Odysseus looks at these two people he's killed for the first time, after he's the first people he kills in the movie, there's just like a brief sting. And it's like, I think on the soundtrack, this track would be like, I don't know, 30 seconds long, because it's basically just these two notes that the movie uses for its theme played in isolation. And I was like, oh, that's nice. That's a deft touch. The other thing is, I think that Juliette Binoche should not go unmentioned. Also a fantastic performance. One of the biggest talking points surrounding this movie was the pairing of Ralph Fiennes and Juliette Binoche, who have been on screen together before, two times in Wuthering Heights and The English Patient. I haven't seen those movies. I'm detecting that Nathan might not be particularly fond of one or both of them.
The English Patient is terrible.
Okay, well, Ralph Fiennes is fantastic. I don't know, maybe he's terrible in The English Patient. And so is Juliette Binoche. She really sells a fragile woman who's kind of holding on to a fool's hope that her husband might return one day. And even in the end, when I'm feeling disappointed and I'm like, what was the point of all this? I do enjoy the scene of the scene where Odysseus and Penelope just kind of have a little conversation. Mm-hmm. From a writing perspective, because at this point I am already disappointed with the narrative, but just because in isolation, I think this is a really good, well-acted scene of two people who have been apart for a long time, beginning the process of readjusting to each other.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's that.
All right. Well, then let's get into ratings. My rating, I've been very negative on this movie, so maybe this rating is going to be a little surprising. But I would say the first half of this movie is really good. And then there's that one great scene with Argos and... yeah, Ralph Fiennes is doing a great job. Juliet is doing a great job. I'm going to give the movie a 5.6. It gets 5 points for the great setup, and it gets 0.6 for that one scene with Argos that made me sad that a dog died.
Well, I'm going to give it, for the third time in 4 reviews, a D+.
Oh my goodness.
There's so much promise in this first half, but it just doesn't go anywhere. And Ralph Fiennes is fantastic. Juliette Binoche is fantastic. There's some good music in here. But even for as much as I respect and admire Ralph Fiennes for his talent, which is quite a bit, I still don't think that any of its constituent parts, or even in aggregate, all of the things that it does well, are good enough to cover the sins of what is a very disappointing conclusion. So let's talk about some things that are not disappointing. At least we shouldn't be. If they are, if Nathan's recommendation is something that disappointed him, I would have some questions. Because we're going to talk about recommendations. Nathan, what is your pairing for this film? Or what is an alternative for this film if people were disappointed in it like we were?
Yeah, so sometimes I go with thematic ties for movies. Sometimes I go with things that are just close by way of they cover a similar time period or have a similar aesthetic sort of thing. In this case, I'm going aesthetic. I'm going to be recommending Stanley Kubrick's Spartacus. It is a swords and sandals classic about Spartacus, a slave gladiator who starts a slave uprising to try and destroy Rome. It's a classic epic. I like it more than Ben-Hur personally. I guess if you're a big Ben-Hur person, you could watch Ben-Hur instead, I suppose. But I think Spartacus is great. It's an early Stanley Kubrick movie. I think it gets overwritten a lot of the times over, obviously, Stanley Kubrick's iconic later half output from 2001 onwards, pretty much, or Dr. Strangelove onwards. But I think this one is really good as well. I think it has great characters. If you really liked Gladiator, I think Spartacus is a fantastic earlier version of Gladiator. And it's got a bunch of moments, too, that at least when I watched it, I was like, this is crazy. How'd they do this in... not how they do this, but like, how did they get this past censors in the 60s? Because I didn't think you could show this. And then I learned that I was watching the version that was released in like the 80s that had a bunch of cut scenes. I was like, oh, they didn't get it past the censors. But it's really good, really well-made movie. Really great main performance from Kirk Douglas. Also, you can support people who were fired due to the Red Scare, because Dalton Trumbo wrote this movie, and it's great. It's just a good movie.
Very interesting. I have not seen that movie, so I cannot comment. My recommendation is going to be the original adaptation, so the 1950s adaptation of All Quiet on the Western Front. I chose...
It's 1930s, bro.
Oh, wow. Way earlier.
Yeah.
Yeah, I chose this because I think that it delivers on the promise that The Return makes of a movie about in this case, the process of becoming disenchanted with violence and with war. This is based on, of course, Eric Remarque's, I'm not 100% sure, classic anti-war novel, and it manages to put in some real... It manages to pack in some real impact for a movie that is, right, somewhat limited in its reach by censorship and by, of course, the technology of the time. Particularly what I think really links these two movies is there's a scene that's not unlike the scene from The Return where Odysseus has returned and is telling his buddies about what happened, where the main character of All Quiet on the Western Front gets leave and goes back to Germany and starts interacting with the people who have a completely different perception of the war and its merits than he does as a person who's actually experienced it. So I think that this movie, if you wanted The Return to be more about violence and war and how people are changed by it, both in their personality and their outlook, then I think that All Quiet on the Western Front will scratch that itch for you.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Great recommendation. Fantastic movie. Yeah, it's much like Spartacus. I think it is a movie that you kind of watch and you're like, dang, we figured this film stuff out really early. Like the 30s, we were making stuff this good? That's nuts. I think it's really neat in that sense.
Well, hey, sometimes, right, you watch a movie and it doesn't connect with you. Sometimes you're in World War I. Sometimes you come home just as your dog is dying. And you think to yourself, man, life sure is hard and full of disappointments.
Wow, so true. What a great segue. Anyway, thank you so much for listening. Genuinely, thanks for listening, because I'm sure this episode's going to have like 2 listeners because no one's seen this movie. But I had a lot of fun discussing it. If you've seen this movie and you have thoughts or something, feel free to send us an email. We love to get those. Like I said at the top of the episode, if you have an idea for a special episode that you think would be fun or you'd like to see, if you have a request for a movie, if you just want to chat, I guess, you can send us an email. We love to see those. We're going to be back next week. It's probably going to be another standard movie review, but we hope you look forward to that, and we hope you have a great week. Thanks so much for listening.